I want to use as a text for this particular message Matthew chapter 5 and verse 13. Several months ago, I was traveling down the road. I think it was actually on my way to Montana camp somewhere in Wyoming or somewhere in Montana. And I was considering the state of affairs of our nation and our people. And Matthew chapter 5 and verse 13 just kept coming up over and over and over again in my mind. Matthew 5 and verse 13, where it says, the part of the Sermon on the Mount, Yeshua the Christ, though he who is often called Jesus, said, "You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has become tasteless, how will it be made salty again? It is good for nothing anymore except to be thrown out and trampled under the foot of men." I want you to listen to that verse again, and I want you to listen to each and every phrase. It says again, "You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has become tasteless, how will it be made salty again? It is good for nothing anymore except to be thrown out and trampled under the foot of men." The Amplified Version puts it this way. It says, "You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has lost its taste, its strength, its quality, how can its saltiness be restored? It is not good for anything any longer but to be thrown out and trodden under the foot of man." You know what? A descriptive verse. It's like a vine overladen with grapes, heavy. Each phrase having something very descriptive and something very distinct to say to us. And it speaks volumes regarding the state of affairs of our nation, our people, and the churches of America. Not only do I want to use this verse as a text for this message, but I want to spend the whole message as an expository sermon on this, just this one verse. It begins by saying, "You are the salt of the earth." Who's the salt of the earth? What would the answer be if I was to ask that question to the majority of Judeo-Christian pulpits today? They would probably tell you that believers, or they'd probably tell you that this is speaking of the salt of the earth being the church. And yet, the church, as people normally think of it, was not even in existence at this time when Yeshua stated these words. In chapter 16 of Matthew, the statement was made that Yeshua was yet to build his church. He said, "Upon this rock, I will build my church." And so the "you" at this time indeed could not be the church. Now, if it wasn't the church, then my question to them would be, then who? Well, you've already answered the question. Simply the nation of Israel. In 2 Chronicles chapter 13 and verse 5, it said that the blessings of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were passed on to David and his progeny through a covenant of salt. Now, I've read that. I don't know how many times I've been through the Scriptures. Several times, all of them. I made a compact with God in 1973 that I never let a day go by where I didn't rise in the morning and read some from His Word. And so I read at least four chapters, if not more, every day. And so I've went through the Bible. I don't know how many times I've read that verse, but until I put this message together, that phrase never hit me. That He passed it on through a covenant of salt. It doesn't tell us. I don't remember anything in the Scriptures where there was a salt involvement when this covenant was passed on with David. But it states that. There's got to be some significance to that statement that this covenant of salt was passed on to David and his progeny. It has to do with the fact that Israel indeed is, or at least was, the salt of the earth. Wasn't Israel chosen out of all the nations to be God's special treasure? I know you know the verse, but let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 7 and read it again. Deuteronomy 7 and verse 6. It says, "For you are a holy people to Yahweh your God. Yahweh your God has chosen you to be a people for His own possession." The footnote, and I believe the King James says, "His special treasure out of all the peoples who are on the face of the earth." And wasn't Israel also chosen to be a blessing to the rest of the world? Turn to Genesis 22, another verse I know you're familiar with. Genesis 22. Verses 15 through 18. It says, Then the angel of Yahweh called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, By myself I have sworn, declares Yahweh, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son. Indeed, I will greatly bless you, and I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens and as the sand which is on the seashore, and your seed shall possess the gate of their enemies. And in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice. So Abraham returned to his young men. There very clearly, as you know, there and in other places, Israel was not only chosen to be his special treasure, but was also chosen to be a blessing to the rest of the world. And as God's special treasure, wasn't it actually in and through Israel that the rest of the world was salted with Yeshua the Christ? I'm not talking about just the fact that Yeshua was a direct descendant through David's line and consequently back to Abraham and Shem. But wasn't she still, at least indirectly, responsible for Yeshua salting the earth? Turn to Matthew chapter 13, verse 44. Verse 44, it says, that, wrong chapter here, Matthew 13, and verse 44, The kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in the field, which a man found and hid, and from joy over it he goes and sells all that he has and buys the field. Now let me ask you, who is the treasure? You all know, don't you? We've already identified it. We know from Deuteronomy 7:6 that Israel was God's special treasure. You know, it's always best, instead of going through the Bible, Gissen by golly style, just trying to choose what just happens to seem best, it's always best to let the Bible be its own best commentary. We know who the treasure was because the Bible identifies who the treasure was. I don't care what the rest of Judeo-Christianity says the treasure was. God said the treasure was Israel. Who's the field? Well, the Bible also identifies that. Matter of fact, in this same chapter, in verse 38, it says, The field is the world. And so we know that the treasure was buried in the world. And we also know whom the man was here who initially buried the treasure and paid all to get it back. That man was identified very clearly as being the Son of God in these parables of the kingdom. Thus, in a roundabout way, Israel, even in her disobedience, was a blessing to the world because he bought the world to get the treasure. Even in her disobedience, and I don't know how God can even use us in our disobedience, but there are times indeed where we even bless the world, at least in this one particular instance, where even our disobedience proved to be a blessing to the rest of the world. I should ask, doesn't Isaiah repeatedly declare also that Israel was God's servant people and witnessing people to the rest of the world? And by the way, if for those of you who still may be having a difficult time with that whole concept, which I know some of you do, but if Israel was God's witnesses, which she clearly was if you go through the book of Isaiah, If Israel as a people were God's witnesses, you might want to ask yourself, if it wasn't the rest of the world she was to be witnessing to, then who was it? Witnesses don't witness to themselves. They witness to someone else. Israel was the witness. Thus the world has to be whom she witnesses to. Wouldn't that be the greatest blessing to bring upon the other nations who weren't predestined for salvation, but to bring them the witness and the gospel of Yeshua the Christ? You know, without a doubt, Israel was to be the salt of the earth, and that responsibility now under the new covenant has passed on to the remnant of Christian Israel. Turn to 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 9. I'm not going to go into it, but it's very clear. I think most of you probably are already aware of it. But 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 1, very clearly, if you dig into it and get beyond the English words, you'll find that Peter was writing, just like James, to the 12 tribes scattered abroad from the dispersion. First Peter says, Peter, an apostle of Yeshua the Christ to those who reside as aliens scattered. That's the same word translated as dispersion in James 1 and verse 1, speaking of the 12 tribes. And Strong's Concordance identifies that. It's defined as Israelite residents in Gentile countries, which, and he goes into the countries where they went, which is exactly where Israel went. And so we know that Peter was writing to Israelites. But we also know he wasn't writing to all Israelites. Because the next two or three verses, if you read them sometime, you'll find that he was dealing with those Israelites scattered abroad who had indeed been born again. Not all Israel any longer, but only the remnant. And we find the same promises now being passed on to that remnant of Israel, that she would be a servant and a witnessing race to the rest of the world. 1 Peter 2 and verse 9, it says, "But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of Him who has called you out of darkness into His marvelous light." The remnant now has the responsibility to be the primary witnessers and servants to the rest of the world. Also, under the Old Covenant, we know that Israel was to season her sacrifices with salt. Turn to Leviticus chapter 2, or listen as I get there. Leviticus chapter 2 and verse 13, it says, "Every grain offering of yours, moreover you shall season with salt, so that the salt of the covenant of your God shall not be lacking from your grain offering. With all your offerings you shall offer salt." I believe the King James says meat offering. And in my, I did digging into a real very deep in preparing this, but it seemed like it could be indicative of either one. But the last statement would be all-inclusive, because it says, "With all your offerings you shall offer salt." Someone may wonder, well, what does that have to do with us? Under the new covenant, we don't make sacrifices. And regretfully, that statement is far too often true. You say, what do you mean? What are you talking about? We don't make sacrifices. This is the new covenant. Like I said, regretfully, far too often that statement is true, because we're supposed to. Turn to Romans chapter 12 and verse 1. Romans 12, verse 1, it says, "I urge you therefore, brethren," I urge you, like Paul, brethren, "I urge you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship." We are the sacrifices. And we are supposed to be the salt of the earth. Now keep in mind, whether we're speaking of old or new covenants, saltless sacrifices were unacceptable before Yahweh. And yet, what did Yahshua go on to say in Matthew 5 and verse 13? He says, "You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has become tasteless, how will it be made salty again?" Now I pointed this out in other messages. There's only one way by which salt can become tasteless. You can crush it, you can grind it, and you can pulverize it, and it will still retain its savor. However, salt can be rendered tasteless simply by dilution. And when modern Christianity is compared with first century Christianity, it has to be admitted that Christendom, at least for the most part, has been diluted from what it once was. There's no comparison. Whereas first century Christianity was turning their world upside down, 20th century Christianity isn't even giving the world a good bump. Billy Graham, after visiting communist Russia several years ago, stated that Christianity in Russia is no different than Christendom here in the quote-unquote home of the free and the brave. You remember, there was an uproar. If you remember that time, there was an uproar from a good majority of Christian leaders at that time that Billy Graham would dare state such a thing. But you know, for one of the first times in his life, Billy Graham was right. Matter of fact, he'd have probably been even more correct had he stated it this way: Christianity in America is no different than Christendom in the USSR. You catch the difference? The proof of that is in what's happening today. In the last couple of years, Russia has been accepting with open arms hundreds, possibly thousands, of Americans missionaries. And the question is why? Well, of course, because communism is dead. And the communist officials, or the Russian officials, want to convert to Christianity. Do you really believe that? If you do, I've got beachfront property right in Scotts Bluff, Nebraska. I'd be glad to sell to you. I'd find a few mountain ranges for you too. You know, the same authorities who welcome Judeo-Christianity with the doctrine they teach on Romans chapter 13 accept with open arms Christian Israel with the doctrine they teach on Romans 13. A year ago, I attended a Bill Gothard seminar, an all-day minister seminar in Denver, Colorado. And it was related that Boris Yeltsin personally entertained Bill Gothard in Russia. Personally. Had him at his home and entertained him. Why? Well, we found out why. Because he went on to explain in this seminar how they were teaching the Russian people that they were to be in complete submission to any and all Russian government authority. Now, do you think that James Brueggemann or Earl Jones or Pete Peters or Ted Weiland would be given the same courtesy? Of course not. So what's going on? Earl? Yeah, they might with Earl. I mean, he almost looks like the past Russian president a little bit. He just needs to get the little design up there. I heard they were able to get rid of that. They found some solution that got rid of it. You know, who knows who we might have here in our midst. What's going on with this? Why is communist Russia accepting all these Christian ministries into their country? Why? Simply because it's part and parcel of the leveling effect which must take place for a new world order or a one world government to be implemented. The world must be leveled politically. Thus, communism is declared dead and renamed democracy. The world must be leveled economically. Thus, third world countries are raised to a higher economic planes, while America is continually, her prosperity is continually lowered, lower and lower. And lastly, the world must be leveled religiously. Think about it. The other two areas are nearly accomplished, if not accomplished, very close to it. However, those alone cannot accomplish what they desire in forming or putting into force or implementing a one-world government. A one-world government cannot be accomplished without the millions of Americans in Christendom believing. Let me stop there before I finish that phrase. Simply believing. Is communism dead in Russia? No, but all it took was for them to convince the American public that it was. That all it only takes. It's just a belief system. That's all it took. It's still dead. And by the way, if you haven't seen it, Bruce McCarthy has put out a great little pamphlet on that very thing, on whether communism is dead. His question in the pamphlet is, if communism is dead, then why in the world are all 10 planks of the Communist Manifesto still in force over there? Call it what you want, it's still communism. And then he goes on to ask, and why are all 10 planks of the Communist Manifesto in place here in America as well? See, it's only a belief system. But a one-world government cannot be accomplished, even with those other two aspects in force, in effect, without the millions in American Christendom believing that Russia is as religiously free as America. You think about that. They'll never accomplish it. There's too great a force, even in Judeo-Christendom, for that to take place. They have got to level it. And so communist Russia has opened her arms to America, American Christianity. And note, I did not say biblical Christianity. She's opened her arms to American Christianity. And why not? The communists have nothing to lose, because American Christianity has been so diluted and compromised to the degree that they are no longer even a threat to the communist principles and plans and propaganda. Doesn't the very fact that what used to be called just Christianity is now called Judeo-Christianity testify to the fact that American Christianity has been diluted, has become tasteless? Now, how would you describe tasteless salt? How would you describe it?
Not descriptive.
Bland? Anything else? How about if we describe it the way that Yeshua described it? Let's look at the next phrase. Or at the phrase we were. What did he say? He said, the next phrase says that tasteless salt is what? Good for nothing. And what a perfect description of the biggest majority of churches and denominations today in America. Good for nothing. Now, I'm sure that many Christians would agree, I'm sure that many Christians would not agree with that. Why, they would claim that the churches today are leading hundreds of thousands to Christ. But did you know that the biggest majority of churches today, the biggest majority of Christendom, aren't even accomplishing that? Because they refuse to teach what the Bible teaches on salvation. And I know, because I used to be a part of it, and so are some of you, and so are some of you probably to this day. They teach something the Bible doesn't teach. This asking Jesus Christ into your heart, praying the sinner's prayer, that cannot be found anywhere in the Bible. And they refuse to teach what the Bible does teach on salvation. Baptism/immersion for the remission of sins, preceded by faith and repentance. They aren't even accomplishing salvation. They're making hundreds of thousands of people secure in a salvation they don't yet have. So for the most part, they're not even getting people into heaven for eternity the way they teach it. So what do you think they're accomplishing here on earth? And one of them is going to respond, "What do you mean earth? That's not a Christian's concern." And yet Yeshua very clearly said, "You are the salt of the earth," or at least you're supposed to be. And the light of the world. You know, between their rapture, going to heaven, kingdom in the future, and Romans 13 mentalities, modern Christianity has indeed become good for nothing. Amen. How many preachers do you know today who are speaking out against Judaism and the Talmud? Usury and the corrupt banking system. Media control and corruption, the Federal Reserve System, the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateralist, globalism and the New World Order, Global 2000, BATF and FBI abuse, and the new vaccination bills. I'll guarantee it's a very small handful out of over 400,000 ministers in America today. Why, most ministers are so heavenly minded, they couldn't even begin to tell you the first thing about any of those areas. That's how tasteless they've become. They wouldn't know what the initial CFR even stand for. Ask a minister, what's a CFR? Cowboys for Rapture. Now, that may identify Pete Peters, but that's not what it stands for. And I really regret he's not here to hear that. That was all off the cuff, too. That wasn't even in my notes. Inspired by God. But that's how tasteless we have become. that they couldn't even address. They don't even know what they don't know anything about Judaism. They don't know anything about the Talmud. They don't know anything about any of those areas. In spite of the fact that we are admonished as Christians to not participate in the unfruitful deeds of darkness, but instead expose them. We're commanded that. And yet they couldn't tell you the first thing about them. What's happened to the watchman on the wall concept? And I'm here to tell you, you may only find that term found in the Old Testament, but I'm not convinced that that didn't carry over to the New Testament as well. What's happened to the watchman on the wall concept? It's nearly become extinct in this day and age. Can you imagine what would happen if those 400,000 ministers, and I'm only talking about the ministers, let alone their flocks, but can you imagine what would happen if those 400,000 ministers were to start speaking out on those issues today? Start hitting them head on? Can you imagine what would happen? You talk about salt! But instead they're silent. And if you haven't heard me say it before, I'll tell you it now. Silence isn't always golden. Sometimes it's just yellow. In other words, sometimes it's good for nothing. You know, I've used this before, and sometimes I may run some illustrations into the ground because I'm not the illustrator, the master illustrator that Pete Peters is. So I have to keep using mine over and over again. But I love this one. It's a cartoon that I believe Mike Green gave to me one time when I was attending church in La Porte. It's a cartoon of a family, normal American family. Of course, it's no longer normal. I guess there's a wife there, and instead of Eve, there's usually Steve in the picture. But so this is maybe a little farther back. But anyway, there's a family here of a husband and father, or husband and wife and their son. The father's working on a crossword puzzle in the newspaper. The woman is reading her Bible, and the little boy's watching a bare-breasted or almost bare-breasted rock star singing on the television set. And the father asked this question as he's working on the crossword puzzle. He said, "What's a six-letter word for something that can help stop the spread of AIDS?" And the wife speaks up and says, let's see, P-R-A-A-Y-E-R, prayer. And the little boy has little dots going up, so he's only thinking the thought, but he's thinking C-O-N-D-O-M, condom. Now, I'm here to tell you, I'm not against prayer. And I believe there is great power in prayer, but I want also to tell you there are times when God expects us to do more than just pray. And that there are some things prayer is not the answer for, and I submit to you that that little boy had a better idea than she did. Now, I don't know, that's not my idea for the solution either. But I'll bet he gets the fact is they don't work too well either. But they will certainly work more on that problem than I guarantee probably prayer work. God had another idea for how that was to be taken care of, but I'll guarantee most of Christendom isn't going to submit it to you. Why? Because that perfectly describes where Christianity is at. You know, not only is much of Christendom not speaking up or standing against anything, not only are they keeping us out of trouble, but in many cases they're getting us into trouble. Either directly or indirectly, they promote usury and debt, unclean meats and the resultant health problems here in America, our prison problems, no-win wars, illegal and unscriptural taxes which finance sodomy, murder, and pornography, illegal aliens, false religion, interracial marriages, and the mongrelization of all races, agricultural problems, and government corruption in general. Now that's a description of salt that's been diluted and lost its savor. Salt that's useless and good for nothing. Putrid. You know, the churches today have become so diluted that they have not only become tasteless in the minds, in the sight of, or in the nostrils, in the sight of most people, or they have not only become tasteless, but they have become putrid in the nostrils of most of non-Christendom today. Let me state that again. I saw my pause sign back there, and I don't know if they stated it well enough for you to understand. But the churches today have become so diluted that they are no longer tasteless in the sight or in the mouths of non-Christians today, but they have also become putrid. And isn't that just what most Christians are doing today? They're sitting in their pews in the four walls of their church buildings and putrefying. And why shouldn't they be putrid to the rest of the world? Now let me tell you that salt can either be a blessing or it can be a curse. And which is it which Israel, even Christian Israel, has become today? Rather than a blessing, she's become a curse. All because her saltless is tasteless, useless, and good for nothing. Yeshua finished his statement in Matthew 5:13 with the judgment upon tasteless salt. He said again, "You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt has become tasteless, how will it be made salty again? It is good for nothing anymore except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men." Now that was more than just a future prophecy of what was to come. It was also a commentary on what had already even happened in the past as well. Turn to Isaiah chapter 10. Isaiah 10 and verses 5 and 6. Listen carefully. It says, "Woe to Assyria, that rod, the rod of my anger, and the staff in whose hand is my indignation. I send it against a godless nation." What godless nation is being spoken of here? The saltless, tasteless, good for nothing nation of Israel. And listen to what it says, "And commission it against the people of my fury to capture booty and to seize plunder, and to trample them down like mud in the streets." It was not only a future prophecy, it had already happened in the past. The record is clear. In the past, when Israel became saltless, God turned her over to be trampled under the foot of men. Now, do you think it won't happen again, even for the remnant of Israel, if she too loses her saltiness? My God, it's already happening. Man, if you can't see that, you are blind. Israel is being trampled underfoot everywhere you look. We're certainly not the trampolees. We're certainly not the tramplers. You know, so many of our people fear being salt. They fear speaking out. I know you've run across this. You know, sometimes it's even, I don't want to hear what you're saying. I just don't even hear it. Because they fear. I mean, they've gone to that extent. But at least they fear speaking out. They fear becoming active. They fear a high profile. Because they believe in doing... Why? Why? Because they believe in doing so, they'll be trampled under the foot by men. Isn't that the case? However, just the opposite is true. It's the tasteless salt, the silent, the inactive, the non-aggressive, the backpedaling, mealy-mouthed, weak-kneed Christian that's trampled and thrown out into the street and trampled under the foot of man. Isn't that right? We get it in total reverse of what God said. Isaiah 51 and verse 23, I believe, is a commentary on what's happening today in Christianity. Don't turn there. I've got it here. It says, "And I will put it into the hand of your tormentors, who have said to you, lie down." They're asking, just lie down. "Lie down that we may walk over you." And then it says, "You have even made your back like the ground and like the street for those who walk over it." Modern Christianity hasn't been forced into the mud. She has willingly became a doormat for the rest of the world to walk upon. They don't even give a good fight. They simply say, lay down. And what does Christianity do? They lay down, face first in the mud. Go ahead, trample right over me. You know, Pete was telling me that during the Branch Davidians, when the Branch Davidians were under siege, that one of the songs that was being pumped into the Waco compound was Nancy Sinatra's song, "These Boots Were Made for Walking." Now, do you think for a moment that was by accident? I'll guarantee you, our enemy knows. They know either they do the trampling or they become the tramplers. Or they become the trampolees. And right now, they're stepping high and coming down hard and grinding their heels in the back of Christendom. By the way, I don't believe that the Branch Davidians in any sense are good representatives of Christianity. So what's new? Why do you think the feds picked them? And do you think it was just by happenstance that about the only time, the only picture you saw of David Koresh was when he was in front of his people preaching to them from an open Bible? He was simply being used as a bad example, as an example for the rest of Christendom, for the rest of the world to think this is what Christendom is. But you know, why shouldn't our oppressors be trampling upon Christianity today? After all, it's what Yeshua said, good for nothing Christianity deserves. David understood that's what he deserved. Listen to Psalms chapter 7. In verses 3 through 5, he writes here, he says, O Yahweh my God, if I have done this, if there is injustice in my hands, if I have rewarded evil to my friend, or have plundered him who without cause was my adversary, let the enemy pursue my soul and overtake it, and let him trample my life down to the ground and lay my glory in the dust. He said, if this is the type of man I am, I deserve to be trampled underfoot. And I'll guarantee you, if you are that type of person, you certainly deserve it if David did. It's rightly our end, if that's our means of doing things. It's simply what we deserve. However, let us rejoice in all things, as we are commanded to do, because it is also the means by which salt becomes salty again. That was the question which Yeshua asked. He said, if the salt has become salty, if the salt has become saltless, how will it be made salty again? And it doesn't appear that Yeshua answers that question in Matthew's account. However, Mark records the very same question. Turn to Mark chapter 9. Mark chapter 9 and verse 50, he says, salt is good, but if the salt becomes unsalty, with what will you make it salty again? Have salt in yourselves and be at peace with one another. And notice he encourages us, he asks the question, and he encourages us, be salty. But you say, where's the answer? Well, in this particular case, the answer came before the question. Look at verse 49. It says, for everyone will be salted with fire. What is fire often indicative of in the Scriptures? Persecution. Not always, sometimes it's other things, but in many cases, it's persecution. So as is often the case, God's judgments are also His means of bringing us back to Him. And we need to rejoice that indeed we're face down in the mud and being trampled under the foot of man. In this case, His judgment. Being trampled under the foot is what makes Christians salty again. Now let me assure you that God's purpose in us being trampled upon will be accomplished. Is anything that God purposes not accomplished? So we can rejoice. We can look forward. We can know that it's not going to continue to be always as it has been, at least in our present lifetime. God's purpose will be accomplished in us being trampled under the foot of man. The salt will once again become salty, and I think you can see that it's already beginning to happen around us. I believe we're in the most exciting days, maybe some of the most persecuted, and I believe they're going to get even worse, because it's going to take that to wake up and to make salty some of the hardest heads and some of the stiffest necks out there. But man, are we in for exciting times when the salt once again becomes salty? The salt will become salty again, for it is and always has been God's design that we be the tramplers, not the trampolees. Listen to these passages. Deuteronomy 33 and verse 29, it says, blessed are you, O Israel, who is like you, a people saved by Yahweh, who is the shield of your help and the sword of your majesty, so your enemies will cringe before you, and you shall tread upon their high places. Listen to Psalms 44 and verses 4 and 5. It says, Thou art my King, O God. Command victories for Jacob. Through Thee we will push back our adversaries. Through Thy name we will trample down those who rise up against us. And let us never forget it. We'll never do the trampling on our own. But it says David understood, we will only do it through Him. Also Malachi 4 and verses 1 through 3, it says, For behold, the day is coming, burning like a furnace, and all the arrogant and every evildoer will be chaff. And the day is coming that will set them ablaze, says Yahweh of hosts, so that it will leave them neither root nor branch. But for you who fear my name, the Son of Righteousness will arise with healing in its wings, and you will go forth and skip about like calves from the stall. And you will tread down the wicked, for they shall be ashes under the soles of your feet on the day which I am preparing, says Yahweh of hosts. And then also Psalms 58 and verse 10 and 11, it says, The righteous will rejoice when he sees the vengeance. He will wash his feet in the blood of the wicked. And then we'll say, Surely there is a reward for the righteous. Surely there is a God who judges the earth. To some, to saltless Christianity, it may seem unchristian. However, I look forward to the day when we dance upon the graves of the wicked, of the Antichrist forces that are right now treading our people into the ground. The song, These Boots Were Made for Walking, is our song, not theirs. It's just something else that they have temporarily stolen, that Esau Edom has stolen from Jacob Israel. But I'll guarantee, more importantly, God guarantees, it will once again, in the end, be Israel's song that she once again sings when she takes dominion and restores the kingdom to her king. Thank you very much.